Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for our final 2017 episode of This Week in Law, in which I am thrilled to have our entire cast of Twill characters on the show. We've got Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, Matt Curtis, and me, and we're scratching our head on a lot of issues here at the end of the year. We'll talk about net neutrality, what's going on there, what you can expect on and after December 14th. We're scratching our head about the Uber and Waymo dispute and the crazy revelations about what's going on in discovery there, what balls are being hidden and by whom. Also scratching our heads at ADT and why they think it's still okay to put a non-disparagement clause in their terms of service. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and Matt Curtis. Episode 409, recorded December 8th, 2017. Humvee full of COD. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law, our last episode of the year, and the gang is all here. I am so excited. My entire squadron of excellent co-hosts is here with me today. We've got Mike Keyes from the Dorsey Firm in Seattle, Washington. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise, and hello to Matt and Emery. Great to be with you on this last show of the year.
Yay, it's so good to see you. It's been such a great year, you guys. Let me just let the audience know who else is here with us. It is Matt Curtis, a law student at Notre Dame. Hello, Matt. Great to see you.
Great to be here. Getting a few breaks from exams today, and so it's nice to join the show and get out of the whirlwind.
Yes, absolutely. What's your exam schedule like? When do you finish?
Either Wednesday or Thursday, depending on how we have one take home. So I get to decide what day that is. So probably Thursday at 5 p.m.
Let's be honest.
Very good. Well, we're sending all kinds of good thoughts your way. Good luck with exams. And speaking of exams, Emery Roan has taken the exam to end all exams as far as lawyers are concerned. Passed it, been sworn in. Totally official California lawyer Emery Roan is joining us from San Diego, California.
And the crowd
Hello,
goes
Emery.
Wild. Hey, Denise. Hey, Matt. Hey, Mike. It's so good to see you. It's been far too long since we've had the full cast on the show. And yes. Thank you, Denise, as always. I appreciate the congratulations. It is very weird.
it's weird to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
Yep. It'll feel less weird over time as soon as you've, you know, shown up in court. Are you planning to go to court at all? What are you planning to do, Emery? Do you know?
I don't really have any plans to be in court for the time being. I'm doing some work. I like privacy policy and tech mm-hmm. policy a lot. So I'm trying to shoot for some work in D.C., maybe in that area. But obviously, having just been barred, I'm keeping my options open, let's say.
Right. I was telling Emery before the show, it gets really real when you show up with your bar cart at the county jail or the city jail and one of your friends has wound up there under untoward circumstances. And because you're a lawyer, you can help them perhaps not spend the night in jail. That's one time when it gets real. And another time when it gets real is when you're standing before your first courtroom bench and saying, may it please the court. And then it gets very, very real.
Well, I just can't wait to have the bar card. I carry precious few cards in my wallet, but I will be carrying my bar card. I'm very excited to be able to flash that.
That's good. Yes, it's good to have on you. It's one of the few pieces of paper that still has value in the world. Emery and I, by the way.
Make sure your business cards have Esquire on them. Don't forget that. Yeah.
Well, I told you guys last week I've already used up the allotted 24-hour period where I can call myself Esquire with a straight face before I just expect someone to want to punch me. So it's we'll have to wait until the next time I'm barred. But
actually, Joshua Lennon, make sure your business cards Make sure your business
Josh
cards
Lennon
are cool.
On Twitter said that my business cards are very cool. But I haven't been told that the period tolls for every time you take like a classy selfie celebrating being barred. So I might be able to toll the period with a couple. I don't know. Is that
yes.
selfie? Is that classy?
So how long can I leave that lower third for you?
There
you know
we go.
What? Oh, you can leave it up for this show. All right, I'll take that. Hold on, let me screen capture that, please. Wait just a minute.
By the way, yay, perfect. Emery and I are declaring ourselves safe from all of the fires in Southern California. For anyone who was concerned, we are in some of the few areas of Southern California that aren't aflame right now. So hopefully that will stay the case throughout the show.
Have you seen any like smog or smoke from the fires, Denise?
Because the winds are so strong and blowing so strongly offshore, what it's doing where we are is blowing all the smoke offshore. So you can look out and see like this wall of smoke out over the ocean,
wow.
But it's not the air quality. From what I can tell, I'm not seeing ash everywhere. And the air quality seems fine where I am. So
that's good.
Yes. Not
are they
again.
Still like not contained?
I think that, most of them are not contained. When I checked last night, the Lilac Fire, which is in North San Diego, that was 0% contained and had burned over 3,000 acres. The one up north, the one in Ventura, is partially contained, but not very much. And it has burned, something beyond the landmass of Washington, D.C. It is enormous.
Wow.
The acreage that it burned up there.
It's very crazy.
Yeah.
I do recommend, just for a PSA to all of our listeners out there, if you're affected by the fires or if you have any family or friends that might be affected by the fires, or if you're just concerned about us, the fire.ca.gov has a good live fire map that updates for the entire state of California. And there's a couple right north of Carlsbad and Temecula that are apparently uncontained active fires right now. So I've got it open in a tab.
All right. Yes. Keep us posted if there are any things that we need to know about. Emery, you and I can back
I was gonna
say,
the show is just going to get cut up like in the middle.
In the meantime, speaking of things aflame, let us talk first about legislation, regulation, and policy. We talked a bit about what's going on with net neutrality last week, but not much. And it's definitely a topic that we need to spend a little bit more time with before the vote later this month on December 14th, pursuant to which the new FCC rule called Restoring Internet Freedom Order is entirely expected to be enacted. There really doesn't seem to be a whole lot that can be done to stop that train from coming into the station on December 14th. Now, that's not to say that there aren't a lot of discussions and activism going on. We'll talk about
activism later.
Later story. Going on right now, definitely it is on people's radar and with good reason. People are very concerned about what is going on and the fact that the open internet order that has been in place now for some time is about to be undone. But that is not to say that that's the period at the end of the sentence. And I think that was the point that I most wanted to leave people with here, finally getting around to discussing this on This Week in Law, is that the legal process will roll on once this rule has been enacted. And it will roll on the way it has been back and forthing between the FCC and various federal courts since roughly 2010. So definitely stay tuned, definitely stay active and informed, let your representatives know what you think about all this and pay attention to the things that, ISPs may decide to do, once this, restoring, what's it called again? The Restoring Internet Freedom Order has been enacted.
Freedom and order.
Yes.
Yeah. Freedom and order go really well together.
REFO would be the acronym.
REFO.
REFO. Anyway, it definitely will give ISPs more leeway to do things that may not be pleasant for consumers. One story that caught my eye this week was AT&T coming out and saying, you know, really the open internet order didn't really change our conduct at all, or, you know, really hasn't given consumers anything that they wouldn't have already had. And the internet was quick to respond. Remember that thing where you were not allowing FaceTime, AT&T, back in 2012? That's the kind of thing we're concerned about. And definitely things like that are exactly what are at stake, and worse, you know, things like paying for certain content and not others, having content filtered for you without necessarily even any voluntary actions on your part. So it's definitely something to pay attention to and watch, but know that years of litigation are about to ensue over the REFO Restoring Internet Freedom Order once it gets enacted this month. So it's definitely a stay tuned moment. I'm sure that you guys have other anecdotes or things that you want to add about this. So Emery, let's start with you.
Sure. So this is furiously pulling up my notes on the last episode of Tech Policy Grind that mm-hmm. we will be releasing on Monday, because we do have two Internet Law and Policy Foundry fellows that joined us for a really in the weeds friendly debate discussion about some of the legal intricacies of the decision that is going to launch on Monday. So I really hope you guys will all listen and check it out. We've got Randy Abro from Randy Abro and Tom Struble. Tom Struble from R Street Institute in D.C. and Randy Abro from the Bronx. He is an attorney, author, tech aficionado, and a candidate for the New York City Council. But we got into a really good discussion about the details of what exactly the argument is on the repeal side and why the opposing the repeal side thinks that that's ridiculous. Obviously, I think that it's pretty clear where I stand on the debate. But just to maybe give a little bit of background for our listeners that might not be sure exactly what we're talking about here, in the Open Internet Order 2015 established three bright line rules and effectively placed regulation over broadband internet access service providers under the FCC, categorizing them as a like utility under Title II of the Communications Act. Now, the repeal, however, is basically rejecting that altogether and saying that BIAS providers should not be considered a public utility. They shouldn't be considered under Title II. And in fact, the FTC, rather than the FCC, is the better regulatory body to protect the open internet. That is the most devil's advocate of an answer that I can give. But in the process of that, it is a straight repeal of the three bright line rules established in the Open Internet Order, the rules that would prevent ISPs from blocking, from throttling, or from allowing paid prioritization. And that third one, paid prioritization, is a really complex issue that has a lot of intricacies as far as like what is paid prioritization? How do programs like Zero Rating work with paid prioritization? Are they violative of the Open Internet Order? Because we've seen, for example, some things like T-Mobile that allows your Netflix to not count against your monthly data allotment at all. And whether that's paid prioritization or whether that's zero rating, there's a lot of controversy and people disagree. But you know, just to toot the Tech Policy Grind horn, you know, I think it's always good when you can get two people that are really – that really believe in the policy arguments that they're making that aren't, you know, just screaming at each other or over each other. And so I hope you guys will check that out. I'm not sure if we, you know, settled the debate. It's a 30 to 45-minute show, but you know, it's good to at least have that perspective on it. And yeah, personally, it's there's a lot to unpack. I guess we could talk about the comments process, but I'd like to hear what Matt and Mike are thinking as well.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the comments process, but let's hear what Matt thinks next.
Yeah, I think that this is a really interesting topic to look at. So I think that we've talked a lot about the policy issues around it, but I think that this is an illuminating experience for looking at an administrative procedure process. So we've seen like the comments are I would say overwhelmingly, you know, you take out the bots and you take out all that stuff in favor of keeping net neutrality in place, but the administrative state is going to move this in the direction of getting rid of net neutrality. And what's going on here is that the administration has the power to interpret the rules upon which they're governed. So this is part of the Chevron two-step that's being talked a lot about, is that if the rule is like is unambiguous, then the administrators have to follow what the rule says. So if the rule said if the statute on its face said, you know, common carriers are defined as companies that provide broadband service, and therefore it has to be part of this, then they would have to do that. But if they don't have to do that, the administrator gets to say, I don't think that this is part of this, or I do think it's part of this. And the judicial review is based on the notice and comments that the record and everything that the administrators put together in the notice and comment, that they decide that it is a reasonable interpretation. So this is why when we're talking about, you know, how can a law be interpreted by one administration one way and another administration the other way? And that all has to do with judicial deference to the administrative state, which is premised on a theory that the government, you know, these individuals are in the space, they know the industry, they have knowledge and competence in this, and therefore they get to decide. I think it's debated both ways. Ultimately, I think it's really about who gets elected matters, and their policy preferences get put in place through the administrative state. But Denise is right about, you know, this is going to go to court and go to trial, and all of this notice and comment and all of this political action right now is really about prepping the judge to decide whether it's rational for their interpretation. So it's a really interesting process, and this is true of all administrative proceedings. I just think this is a good example of it.
Right. I think that's a really good point, Matt. And I think that also prepping the judge will be whatever ISPs do whenever this Restoring Internet Freedom order becomes final. If all hell breaks loose, there's going to be, that's going to be evidence that the comments saying all hell break loose, or it will break loose, were correct.
They would be very, very short-sighted to do, more invasive things before this goes to trial and has a final ruling. So I would be shocked if they started off right off the bat as soon as this rolls by, you know, throttling people all over the place, because they can do that after it goes to final verdict, though.
Yeah, the scary thing is I think it'll be subtle. I think there will be changes benefit the ISPs that people just, you know, it could just sort of slip right by them if they're not paying attention.
Well, that's the argument against zero rating and paid prioritization. You know, it's why people get very heated when they're talking about whether or not T-Mobile is providing a service to its customers when it's letting your Netflix not count against your monthly data allotment. It is a really complex in the weeds issue. And yeah, I am on your side, Denise. I think that, you know for a fact, it's not an opinion, but it is a fact that these ISPs just have buildings full of attorneys that will be combing over these to try to craft their compliance just exactly as far as they need.
Right. So, Mike, give us your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, the only additional thing that I wanted to mention is actually this resource. It was written for Wired by Professor Tim Wu of Columbia Law School, entitled How the FCC's Net Neutrality Plan Breaks with 50 Years of History. It's a really fascinating account of how this whole concept of net neutrality came to be in the first instance. So I would definitely commend that that particular article to folks if they want to do a deeper dive on the history and Professor Wu's take on what's going on here. good stuff.
Yeah, definitely. It's so awesome. I want to hit on just a single point of it, which is you hear it like so frequently that, net neutrality, the internet was fine before 2015 and net neutrality is only a concept that dates back to 2003 at the latest. So, you know, what we're doing is just a return to normalcy. But Tim Wu does a really excellent job of pointing out that, oh, wait, guys, if you're saying that, you're ignoring the fact that these net neutral positions were really like part of the very building blocks of the internet, and it was part of the initial conception of what the internet did and what made it special. Great, go read it, it's awesome.
Right, and you can find that article and everything else that we've used and reviewed to prep for the show today at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're doing episode 409 this week. Let's talk about the comment process for a moment. Certain Democrats in Washington have argued that next week's vote should be postponed because the comment process was so broken here. Matt, I think at one point you mentioned putting aside all the bots. It's hard to put aside all the bots. Yeah. The bots that happened here make me feel like we're living in an episode of Mr. Robot. And just the fact that you can have one of our most important government agencies so gamed this way is really, really disturbing. Some 21 million comments were submitted during the comment period. And as far as I can tell, the FCC has no way of knowing the legitimacy of most of them. So certainly something needs to change, and hopefully people are paying attention in government to bringing their systems into our actual century here and remedying this kind of situation. What were you going to say, Emery?
I mean, it's such a tough problem to solve. I'm not sure if I said it on the show before, but the first time I was sort of aware of this type of botting, astroturfing, identity theft, it's tough to call it what to call it. But back when I was at Privacy Rights working on, in the whole privacy community was working on pushing forward these bias privacy rules at the end of Tom Wheeler's tenure as FCC chairman, during the comment period then, we were having intra-organization meetings about this, comment process where we're seeing thousands and thousands and thousands of comments being filed that are very, very similar or, close to similar. That are all, against these bias privacy rules. So I don't want to put my, conspiracy hat on or lob any accusations anywhere, but there's something weird going on. And it takes a lot of money to do this kind of activity. I don't know. I don't want to say that, but the other issue that really is interesting to me is that, the fact that it is so difficult to verify these is only going to get worse. There was a really great tweet from someone over this past week about this NVIDIA live translation software that can take a photograph of a sunny day and make it look like it's a photograph of a wintry day, or they can do it to live video. And they did things with like changing cats into dogs. It's the point being that all of these sort of machine learning AI tools are getting much, much better. And so if you look at these comments that are filed, they look like at least a lot of them could be the product of some sort of natural language algorithm or pushing out, variations on a theme of a comment. And with a tool like that, you can make millions of comments that look like they might be humanish, or it might, they're all saying the same thing, but they're, it's difficult to say, okay, this is a human saying this statement versus this is a machine algorithm that's just basically mad-libbing, different combinations of phrases and words to voice their opinion.
Right.
To make matters worse, of course, there's these comments are being filed with the names and addresses of real people. And so how are they getting that data? How are they getting the names and addresses is up in the air. But there's huge, rampant identity theft, essentially. There's some tools that you can go to search the comments to see if your name or your address was used. None of mine. I wasn't used, but I do know friends that do show up in this list. It is a very weird, scary window into the future of what policy decisions and what activism and political action looks like when AI and machine learning tools have just totally eradicated the idea of verifiable fact.
I have deep concerns too about participation in the process when verification turns on your identity, your address, your name, all that information being publicly available in order for you to participate and comment. I think it's going to have an incredible chilling effect. You know, there are probably people working for Verizon who would rather not know that they wanted to submit a comment in support of open internet, and they're just not going to do it. And that's an extreme example, but there are all kinds of reasons why, you want to participate in the process, but still remain somewhat anonymous or protected I don't know.
And on the other hand, just because a comment is a form comment doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bot, one of the great innovations of the internet has been these tools that allow you to call up your senator and complain about the, net neutrality rules. These types of tools that ease the friction of political activism rely on these ideas of like form letters and, just making it easy for like one click to have your voice heard. So on the one hand, you don't want to just say that, okay, well now for the comment process, we're going to make it stricter requirements of, what you have to prove in order to comment, because that's going to shut off a whole host of voices that would otherwise be heard. But yeah, it is a weird situation where, if I was to put my conspiratorial cynical hat on, it would be an effective method of sabotaging the entire comment process.
The reason why it's not an effective means of sabotaging the comment process, though, is that what you're doing is you're commenting to prep for the judge to look at it. And so the numbers of people that are for something or against something really don't matter. And the comments for something also really don't matter at all. It's only
then
the comments
that
matter. So that's just optics. So that's just like you're putting them up there so that when you get in front of the news media that you can say that 300,000 people did this. But in terms of what the judge is looking at substantively, if there's two comments that are the same and not like the same words, but the same in substantive understanding of the policy decision that's being made, they're grouped together and the reasoning only has to relate to one of them. So if there's 10,000 people who give like one substantive reason for another thing and one person who gives a substantive reason for another thing, the judge, the record has to prove that is reasonable under both of those, no matter that there is a numerical difference in those two. So while I do think that, all these tools are really important for contacting your senators and doing all that kind of stuff, it's not like if you're commenting on an administrative proceeding, it is important that you provide a viable substantive understanding of the policy that's at hand. That is different than what other people are saying, because that is what a court has to weigh it against. And I think that this is like a basic thing when we think about the administrative state. We think about it in terms of votes, because we're at base a democracy, and so we think about if I vote for one thing, then it's going to matter, and if 10,000 people vote for the same thing, it's going to matter. But that's not the way that notice and comment works. And it's really about the substantive arguments that are being put forth really to the judge that matter.
Good points, Matt. Mike, any thoughts?
Nothing further.
Okay. One thing to bear in mind, of course, the vote is next week on the 14th, but the big net protest day is scheduled for December 12th, next Tuesday. The Break the Net protest, which takes its cue from the SOPA and PIPA protests several years ago. I see that some websites are already putting notices up and helping bring attention to the open internet issue. I did speed test right before the show, as I always do, and they have something about keeping the internet fast that pops up when you go and do your test. So this has already begun, and I'm sure we'll see more and more of it as we get to next Tuesday. It was certainly effective for SOPA and PIPA. It's not going to stop or delay the vote this time.
Just because it's not cited individually in the I understand what you're saying, Matt. I need to think a little bit more on how I can formulate a proper rebuttal. But I do think that this points to a problem, like a systemic fundamental problem that we have not really grappled with yet. And I think it has some serious implications in political activism, because the SOPA protests, I mean, all of internet activism so far has relied on these kind of mass movements. And just because
SOPA and PIPA was very effective because the Obama administration was willing to listen to people. And if the Trump administration just decides that I don't care what people say, then that was a political change. That was a policy change that they made because of comments. And that could happen with Ajit Pai. I just don't see it in the cards. I think that this is part of the plan. And if they don't want to listen to these comments, they can go through with the policy. The Obama administration decided that the policy – we've heard from people, and it worked effectively if the administrator is willing to listen. I just don't see that the Trump administration is, like, no matter how many people say we don't want this, they're just not – I just don't think they're going to listen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that point. I just would push back to say that it's not important. It is important. It's just not going to be a deciding factor, and they're not going to listen to us. But it's important that they're not going to listen to us.
I just mean important in terms of, like, the legal consequences of this.
Bingo. Gotcha.
I don't mean in terms of, you know, substantively or feeling like people are participating or, you know, anything like that. I just mean that when the judge looks at the record, it's not going to matter about – That's all I mean. And it may matter, you know, it may influence his vote, but, like, in the theory of administrative law, it shouldn't matter. That's all I'm saying.
Right. And as far as the legal consequences go, I recommended this last week. I'm going to mention it again this week for folks who want to gaze into the crystal ball and know, you know, exactly what to expect after December 14th. Del Cameron has an article at Gizmodo called "What Actually Happens the Day Net Neutrality Is Repealed." And it goes through in great sort of deep in the weeds detail, what happens next, who files, who's motivated to file, what court it gets heard in. Once we've got a court, what happens after that? And it points out at the end of a long tunnel, there may well be a decision that disagrees with the order. So it could be years from now. But they've got, one law partner from a big firm in there quoted that, in his opinion, and I think in the opinion of various others, new, what did we decide to call it? RIFO, Restoring Internet Freedom Order, is quote unquote very vulnerable on appeal. But that's what the appellate process is all about, and what may well happen. The end of it is that the Restoring Internet Freedom Order could be reversed. There's a great quote in this piece that says it's like everything in government, especially in administrative processes and rulemakings, it's never really over. It's not supposed to be. It's a continuing conversation. So, we've certainly seen that on this issue since 2010. They also comment that there's also the chance this ends up in the Supreme Court, whose makeup by that time may be entirely different. The judicial review of Pai's order could very well extend into the next White House administration. The war for net neutrality, in other words, has only just begun. So stay tuned and stay informed.
Just one more quick comment. The put Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court actually increases the likelihood that this would be overturned. He has come out he wrote a dissenting opinion, or maybe it was a concurrence, but he came out against the Chevron doctrine. So there's Thomas and Alito and Gorsuch, at least on the conservative bench, who don't agree with the Chevron doctrine, which leads to this outcome. So you're looking at a situation where liberal members of the Supreme Court may be more willing to vote for this for the substantive outcome. And you have three conservatives who don't want the procedure that's getting to the answer. So it could be an interesting alignment if it gets to the Supreme Court in terms of that. So if the court's just the way it is today, you know, there's conservatives who don't actually like this doctrine because it gives too much power because it allows the administrators to determine what the law is, and so you get these massive swings, like we're having.
Exactly. Yes, go ahead, Mike.
One other thing I wanted to mention here. I mean, depending if what we're calling it, REFO. depending on what happens with REFO, you know, don't forget about the FTC, because the FTC could very well get into the act here too, if ISPs start doing what the FTC would consider unfair or deceptive practices with respect to this whole issue. The FTC could get into the act and bring enforcement actions under Section 5 against ISPs. So that's another interesting issue that's kind of lurking in the background here.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's part of the whole move toward this new rulemaking toward REFO is that the FTC used to have a more active role here and should again have that role, that it's not – the FCC seems to want to back off and say this is not our province. Come back, FTC, and do your job. So it'll be interesting to see if that winds up playing out as well.
That would just be so the Communications Act of 1934 is still in the law, still in the books. It says that the FCC has purview over all communications utilities. It's 2017. I think that if we were to put regulation of biases into FTC, it would be doing so on a legal fiction. Like it's a utility company. I think everyone agrees. Everyone should agree, at least, that internet companies access
is a utility. They've been back and forth in federal court on that.
I just haven't heard
years.
A single good argument on why bias internet service, why broadband internet access service is not a communication utility, but telephone access is and dial-up internet access is. It doesn't make any sense.
Nope. I tend to agree with you there. Something else that's sort of on the docket in Washington that you've probably not heard of because there's so much else going on in Washington, but is kind of interesting, is called the CASE Act. That's short for Copyright Alternative in Small Claims Enforcement. And this is an idea we've certainly discussed on the show before. So it caught my eye that it actually is now a proposed piece of legislation and could become law. And what it does is, if it did become law, would establish a small claims process for copyright offenses, which would have damage awards up to $15,000 per infringement or $30,000 per case, which is certainly a darn sight better than $150,000 per infringement under the statutory damages provisions. So in some ways, this seems to be a step in a small interest kind of direction with copyright law. However, EFF and Public Knowledge are concerned about it. They think that, first of all, it would be connected to the Copyright Office, and they worry that there would be a bias toward copyright holders in the adjudication of these claims. And secondly, I think they think, you know, much like the settlements that we saw in the music industry when people were flagged for having download activity and then sued and shaken down, you know, in the small thousands of dollars realm just to make the cases go away. I think they're looking at this as a way, you know, we can get payouts to the entertainment industry in small thousands of dollars that don't necessarily trigger a whole lot of outrage, but do trigger a whole lot of income to the entertainment industry. So the CASE Act is something to look at. I haven't really made up my mind about it yet. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I think there's some positive and negative aspects to it. I do like the concept of having a small claims court associated with smaller copyright claims. Copyright, of course, is exclusively federal jurisdiction. So to the extent that you have a claim as a copyright holder, you have to bring that claim typically in federal court. Which, you know, it's fine for companies that are have the means and resources and legal teams to do that. But if you're a small artist, if you're a photographer or an artist or somebody else that has whose work has been infringed, it can be difficult to enforce those rights when it's a smaller scale work. So I like it because it gives folks, you know, the little guy an opportunity to potentially enforce his or her rights. But I do think there are some potentially problematic aspects to it. One of the criticisms is that it's an opt-out procedure, meaning that if you get a notice, at least under the bill as it's currently formulated, if you get a notice that, that an action has been started before the Copyright Office, if you don't do anything, then you're potentially locked into that process. And so that's been one issue that people have flagged, that, look, this should be an opt-in. You should have to affirmatively say that you will submit to this process as opposed to an opt-out process. And that, I do think, is a pretty legitimate criticism. But it's very early on in the stages. I think it's just been referred to the Judiciary Committee at this point. So as far as I know, it's still potentially a ways out, if I've got this right, from ultimately passing. So we'll see what happens. But I think the concept is a good one, but there still needs to be some kinks worked out with it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yep, I agree. What do you think, Emery? Pro, con, still making up your mind?
I'm still making up my mind. You know, I was reading through the text of the bill today. What was interesting to me is the copyright claims officers that will be sitting on the small claims court. They're not judges. They are appointed by the Copyright Office. And the process for picking, it's a three-judge panel, it looks like. One of the judges, I'm trying to skim it right now to pull up the right section. But essentially, they're going to try to get one attorney that has experience on the copyright holder's perspective, one attorney that has experience advocating for copyright users. So presumably, the way that's phrased, I hope that may mean, you know, fair use users, or, you know, people that want to use copyrighted works. And then a third person that has experience. This is what concerns me. Where's the? It's a third person that has experience dealing with, I'm not going to pull up the quote, which is going to totally butcher why I'm saying this, but essentially it's like a third person that's going to be the tiebreaker that has experience working in alternative dispute resolution and also has experience dealing with copyright issues of this kind, or something to that effect. But my concern is the same that the EFF and Public Knowledge have put forward, and that's about the maybe bias that the Copyright Office already has towards copyright holders. They've never really been they don't have a great track record as far as supporting strong fair use protections or supporting strong copyright users protections. Just to go back to, you know, for example, the 1201 exemption process, the process by which exemptions to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act are agreed upon is a repeated process that you have to go through every 3 years. And every 3 years, the Copyright Office re-adjudicates like all of these exemptions. They look at the same arguments that they heard 3 years ago, and it's not necessarily sure that they're going to come down the same as they did 3 years previous. It's not always a great environment to be arguing as a copyright user or as a you know, fair use advocate. So there's some concern about, well, if there's two out of the three copyright claims officers are not copyright user advocates, are we just going to see this as like a rubber stamped for copyright plaintiffs? But I don't know. You know, as we've talked about on the show before, I agree with Mike that in theory, the idea of a small claims copyright court does sound like a good idea. It's just, as with everything, it's concerns about the details.
It's in the details. What do you think, Matt?
This is the kind of what Emery is talking about, is the same issue of having an administrative judge determine the validity or invalidity of a patent is what we're seeing in the oil states case, which we're going to talk about here in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the benefits is that it's faster, it's cheaper, and it's and theoretically it gets you to the right answer. The deficit is that you like it's an administrative procedure, and therefore they're responsible to the president. And if the president says, I want more copyright protections, then the administrative judge pretty much, you know, they're going to give it to him. And if the president says, I want less copyright, you know, if I want less copyright and more fair use. I mean, that's the kind of the whole theory of why judges have life tenure and, you know, salary is that they're not, you know, the president or the Congress or whatever can't come in and tell them, you know, how they should judge the law. So that's kind of the, you know, that's always the issue with having ALJs. I didn't get a chance to read this. Where is the venue for this? Is this only in D.C. then for the small claims court?
Good question.
God, that seems like it would be really disadvantageous for just about everybody.
Yeah,
I don't know the answer.
If they were going to do this where you could Skype in, I would be much more into it.
That'd be sweet.
Yeah, but if it's just in D.C., the benefits shrink a lot for me.
Right.
I want to read just – I found the section. So rather than sounding like a fool and just stammering earlier, I'd like to read what it – copyright claims officers. Each copyright claims officer shall be an attorney with no less than 7 years of legal experience. Two of the copyright claims officers shall have substantial experience in the evaluation, litigation, or adjudication of copyright infringement claims, and between them shall have represented or presided over a diversity of copyright interests, including those of both owners and users of copyrighted works. The third copyright officer shall have substantial familiarity with copyright law and experience in the field of alternative dispute resolution, including the resolution of litigation matters through such means. So I think that, you know, that just leaves a lot of questions.
Yep.
It does. And the venue issue is a big one, too. So we will continue to monitor this and see if any of those questions get answered. In the meantime, we need an MCLE passphrase to put in at this point in the show. I think we'll use Break the Net in honor of what's going to go on next Tuesday. We put these phrases in for lawyers or others who like to listen to or watch the show for professional credit in their field. We'll put another one in before the end of the show. There are some oversight bodies that like to have some way of demonstrating that you actually watched or listened. So this is our way of trying to help you out with that. If you want more information and are a lawyer, head on over to wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there. If you're a lawyer in the United States, we have some resources for you there on how you might go about applying to receive continuing legal education credit for watching or viewing the show in your jurisdiction. So let us move on to the drama that unfolded last week in the Waymo Uber case. This is the trade secrets case that has to do with secrets that were allegedly brought from Uber to Google by way of its Waymo arm. I have that right? It's secrets that went from Uber to Google and not the other way around. Mike, help me out here.
I think the claim is that Uber or a company that was acquired by Uber had taken trade secrets of Waymo, which is the self-driving car division of Alphabet, Google.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. We are now headed down the self-driving road in the right direction. secrets alleged to have been appropriated by Uber when it hired Way.
I do want to point out that confusion that you had, Denise, I had it as well. And I just would like, as someone like, especially Matt, you can speak to having, you know, in law school, you read a bunch of historical opinions and the language is very precise. And I think that may be a side effect of more casual speaking judges and attorneys and the language of the courtroom, because when it's reduced to a transcript, there's a lot of things like, you know, you said this to you, right? Or just confusion about like, wait, who's saying what and where and when is what's going on? So,
all right. So surprise, Uber is alleged to be the bad guy here. And it got worse last week. And the way in which it got worse is there are federal prosecutors actually looking at Uber's conduct here to see if federal criminal charges should be brought against Uber for its activity here. This is a civil case at the moment. And those federal prosecutors went to Judge Alsup, the judge in this case. Judge Alsup was also the judge in the Oracle versus Google case that we're going to talk about a little bit later, too. And these federal prosecutors said, hey, we've got a letter. We're going to give it to you. We're not going to make it public. The judge has not made it public. But it had some information about Uber basically hiding the ball, not disclosing things that it knew or should have known or should have disclosed in the litigation. And so a firestorm that had nothing to do with the actual wildfires in California ensued in court last week as Judge Alsup tried to make sense of all of this. One of the fallouts of this is the case was scheduled to go to trial at the end of December. That has now been postponed until February. And in the meantime, when you read through the transcripts of the days of court proceedings on this, you can see that Judge Alsup is just at his wit's end in dealing with these parties and particularly Uber. The lawyers for Uber find themselves in the situation of having to say, hey, we didn't know any of this was going on. If it did happen, you know, it wasn't our directions to our client, which is never a good position to be in as a lawyer when your client is accused of doing bad things. So the judge's patience is coming to an end, and the case is not coming to as rapid of an end because the judge went ahead and postponed things. Mike, you've probably been watching the procedural back and forth here more closely than I have. What would you add?
I have. I mean, this is like made for TV trial.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really something. I mean, I've never heard of a civil trial being postponed. I mean, the federal government, the Department of Justice swoops in, you know, provides a sealed document to the court, and the court, decides to delay trial. I mean, they were set to go to trial, and literally this happened, I think, at the pretrial conference. And so now, as you mentioned, Denise, the trial is delayed until February. There's so much drama here associated with this secret shadow system that Uber allegedly had in place, and all of this encrypted messaging that went back and forth between Uber employees. So you've got that piece of drama, which is pretty heady stuff. Then you've got the whole issue about this letter from Rick Jacobs' lawyer, who is the former Uber employee, that had written a rather scathing letter about these Uber practices. Uber never turned that over in discovery. And of course, Waymo was going crazy saying that this letter should have been turned over to us months ago. You've got interesting drama associated with the search terms that the parties exchanged during the course of discovery.
That was my favorite.
Explain
that in some detail, Mike, because I think people will just be blown away.
Yes. Yeah, so how it works typically in any case of any size in federal court is the parties just don't turn over all their emails or electronic documents. Typically what happens is some sort of electronic discovery order is entered by the court, and the parties then agree to search their systems using search terms. And it can vary from case to case, but say in a typical case, or at least typical cases that I'm involved in, it could be anywhere between 10 to 20 different search terms. So we agree on search terms that we're all going to go back and search our client's systems for. Well, apparently, this letter that's at issue didn't come up in Uber's search because it didn't have any of the search terms in it. And it came out in court that one of the search terms that – or Waymo, I guess – neglected to have Waymo be a search term in the search terms that it gave to Uber, which I think a lot of people were scratching their head at. I mean, of course you would want to have the name of your company, Waymo, in the search terms that that you have the other side search their systems for.
In a case about appropriating trade secrets from Waymo, yeah. You didn't include the search term Waymo in the e-discovery process.
This may be a function, though. This may be a function, though, of Google just changing the names of their companies just way too much. That at the time, it was some other name of a company, and like they would have used up all their search terms looking at all the names of their companies.
Right. Wasn't there some sort of assertion that we couldn't have them search for Waymo because then we would have been drowned in documentation or
booleans, guys? Booleans, yes. Come on.
What would Google do with more information? Who knows?
Right, exactly. Like, Google bad at parsing information. Wow.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, you got all of that, and then Denise, as you had mentioned, Judge Alsup, very experienced, smart judge, who's been involved in some major trials between tech titans. I mean, he's just exacerbated or exasperated by this by everything. This is just going to be fascinating to see how it plays out. Yeah, there's some doozies for the judge in this case.
So essentially, Waymo is pushing back against the idea that Uber can then ask Waymo about any kind of ephemeral messaging tools that they might use. And Judge Alsup, I'm going to quote from an Ars Technica article written by Cyrus Farivar earlier this week. And this is also the sort of confusion that I was talking about earlier. Judge Alsup wasn't having any of it. This is a direct order and the public ought to be aware, he said. I can't stand it when Waymo or the other side wants to have it both ways. You have the court's permission to ask not only the practice but the policies about ephemeral communications when they were at Waymo and then preserve those records where they obstructed your inquiry because they may be shown to the jury. Now, this is what I talk about confusing language that I wish people would avoid. A few moments – and just like help me parse this sentence, listeners. A few moments later, Judge Alsup was unequivocal addressing Perlson, quote, "You're trying to blame them for ephemeral and they get to show if you do it just as badly as you do it," he said.
Yes, which comes across fine in a courtroom and not so much in writing. Yes, indeed. Well, this whole ephemeral communication thing I think is one of the most fascinating parts of all this. Of course, we're talking about cutting edge tech companies using cutting edge technology, taking the advice of people like us who get on the internet and say, hey, you know, use secure communications, or I guess secure is not the same as ephemeral, but still communications that may make it harder to see the content of what it is you are communicating. And they're taking that to heart and they're doing it. And now we're seeing, a judge say, hey, if you've got messages that are self-destructing, I think that looks really shady.
They're very selectively doing it. They were using these self-destructing messages when they were out tracking the Waymo cars.
Other side of it was the industrial espionage branch of Uber that apparently exists just to do, quote, market analysis. And it's just literally exfiltrating data apparently from other companies, but allegedly. Sorry, Matt.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think you said it with better emphasis than I would have. So it's not like Uber's using encrypted data that self-destructs in all of their communications. I think that's what the judge was upset about. And so,
aren't they, in addition to these ephemeral communications, isn't there the secret server where a bunch of things were stored, and that was kind of outside of the normal process that would typically be used for storing corporate data? Wasn't that also a big part of the court was disturbed about?
I think that's what the court was upset about. It was like, so you let them search, you know, because you had to, because that's part of the court process, is that they get to search your server. Well, if you have two servers and all of the relevant information is on one and you let them search the other, then you're not complying with the process of justice, which is discovery and, e-discovery and like all of this. So if you're building in dual systems to subvert it, it just looks really bad.
Yeah. You know, the other the other thing that I think is really interesting about the judge's comments is, you know, typically discovery disputes, every case has a discovery dispute. Some disputes are larger than others, this one being an example of that. But typically juries don't hear about discovery disputes. You know, the jury gets to decide the facts that are relevant to the underlying dispute. But, you know, all the back and forth and the discovery motions and all of that, that goes out the window when you go to trial. But here, it sounds like Judge Alsup is considering allowing some of this evidence to come in, particularly if there's evidence that the documents were destroyed. I mean, that can be very damning and can be heard by a jury or the fact finder in a case, depending on the circumstances. And it sounds like maybe Judge Alsup is considering letting some of that evidence come in, which could be very very hurtful.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting case in so many ways, and of course, poor Judge Alsup having to parse all of this. It does seem like I wonder what will happen if these federal prosecutors decide they're going to press charges. What will happen to the civil proceedings at that point? Because certainly they seem concerned enough to communicate with the federal judge in the civil case, which is unusual in its own right. And I definitely think – go ahead.
The reason that the AUSA got wind of this was because mm-hmm. Judge Alsup informed them that they should look into this. So like the whole thing is very unusual. Yeah. Maybe Mike or you, Denise, could know more, but I don't know of examples – where a judge is looking at a trade secrets case and says, you know, hey, you know, attorney's office, like this is something you need to be aware of. So the whole thing looks bad.
I am so legitimately interested. I'm sure that if we haven't seen, if it's not out there already, that in the next few years, some very cool law professor is going to have a whole class about Uber. In fact, if that already exists out there, listeners, maybe let me know. We can talk about it on the show. But it's just – you can make a whole like lesson plan for multiple semesters about just what's been going on with Uber in the past year.
But this is the future of self-driving. So what's amazing about all of this is like all this subterfuge and all of this intrigue is all based on like the technology invented by this gentleman, Corey Lewandowski, which literally made the technology possible for both – Anthony, I'm sorry. made the technology possible for both Uber and Google. So we're talking about like the pinnacle of the height of technology innovation. So it's just really exciting. And so, yeah.
I would watch this movie is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think, Mike, too, this whole how is the company communicating and storing data thing. Obviously, Uber was doing things that aren't making the judge very happy here. But I also think that Uber is doing things that probably aren't all that uncommon these days as companies continue to leverage the technologies that are available to them. And, you know, obviously, you can't destroy records relating to pending litigation. There are ethical and legal barriers mm-hmm. to that. But records destruction policies in general are very common. And I think secured communications in a world where parties are trying to protect trade secrets in a competitive environment are probably very common too. And I think this is just the litigation world that we've arrived at today, and that this case is a window into that. Do you agree?
Oh, I totally agree with that. And yes, I think every company has some sort of document destruction process on their books, or at least I would speculate that most companies do. But of course, as soon as you have a reasonable suspicion or a reasonable belief that a third party may have a claim against you, then you have an obligation to – the company has an obligation to make sure that documents relevant to that claim are preserved, and that any document destruction processes in place get stopped. Mm-hmm. So – you know, we'll see what happens here. I mean, this is a big, as we've talked about on the show before, you know, e-discovery is very, very commonplace now. And, you know, it can be easy to get tripped up, even if a company's acting in good faith. It can sometimes be tricky, and it gets even more interesting when a company may be acting in a nefarious way. So I can't wait for this trial to happen to see ultimately how this plays out, and then write the screenplay after.
Yes.
Hey, Mike, would being asked to indemnify a new employee typically raise that? I believe the term is like spoilage or something like that. Would it put you on notice that you need to preserve the evidence from spoilage if you're asked to indemnify?
You mean new employee comes on the scene and says, "I need you to indemnify me against third party claims"?
Yeah, because the case that happened here is that Landowski like admitted to Uber that he had taken this, but he said he wasn't going to bring it to them. So, and he asked for indemnification at the same time. So would that have put them on notice that they needed to preserve documents?
Yeah, I mean, there may be an argument there, Matt. I mean, okay. I guess it would depend on what the substance of that communication was,
yeah.
and how much information they were provided from the outset. But typically, we think of document destruction processes that need to be stopped in response to some sort of formal or maybe even informal notice from an adversary that there's a claim against you. I mean, typically, okay. That's put in writing in a demand letter, or obviously a lawsuit would qualify too. But once you have a reasonable belief that you have adverse interests against a party that may be asserting rights against you or that is asserting rights against you, then all bets are off. You have obligations to preserve documents.
All right. Well, we promised earlier in the show we would get around to an Activision case, and we do have an interesting trademark dispute involving Activision and its incredibly lucrative Call of Duty franchise. Here is a trivia question for you boys. Don't peek at the article and cheat. Okay. What is the acronym? What does Humvee stand for?
Oh, the acronym is HMMV or something, right? Oh,
HMMWV stands for High Mobility Multi-Purpose Wheeled Vehicle. Which are those, you know, military trucks. There we go. If you're watching the video, you can see they look like Hummers. And I don't know the relationship between Humvee and Hummers. I know that Hummers are not being manufactured for, at least I believe they're not being manufactured for the public to buy anymore. I'm not seeing them all around anymore, except
it's
if
the
they
same
are
company.
Old. Sorry? It's the
it's
same
the
company?
Same company. Yeah.
Company's called AM General LLC. And
yeah, they're right here in Indiana.
Ah, there we go. All right. So they're not happy because I don't play Call of Duty myself, but I know people who do, and I've certainly seen these images in the game. And you saw one in the article just a moment ago. These things are all over the game Call of Duty, and they're very distinctive looking. But then I would say so is a tank, and so is a particular kind of aircraft.
Thing, right?
You know, it is a military vehicle, not just a branded, distinctive-looking vehicle by AM General LLC. Well, AM General LLC doesn't feel that way. They've sued Activision for trademark infringement. Let's see, in factoid from this article, Activision has sold over 250 million copies of Call of Duty and is reporting some $15 billion in revenue related to the game. And AM General thinks that having Humvees in the game is contributing to that success and that there's some sort of confusion going on that AM General, quote unquote, licenses the games or is somehow involved in their creation. So, Mike, what do you think?
I think this is a very interesting case that raises some rather unique issues under trademark. So, mm-hmm. What we have here is you, as you said, is the the introduction of the AM General trademark in the form of the vehicle into the game. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're claiming, as trademark owners typically do, that, hey, look, you're using my registered trademark and you're creating confusion. You're going to people that play your video game are going to think that we are somehow sponsoring or otherwise authorize the use of our marks in your game. On the other side, the defense is interesting here, because what the defendant is going to say is, well, look, I'm not incorporating your vehicle into the game to trade off your goodwill. What I'm doing is that this vehicle itself is a stock vehicle that you would see in real life in military scenarios. So all we're doing is incorporating the Humvee into Call of Duty to make it realistic. And there's some pretty decent support for that type of argument. And it really turns on kind of a First Amendment type of analysis that, look, this is an expressive work. We're incorporating this, and we kind of need to incorporate it into our work in order to make our work realistic. So that issue's been litigated before. I think an interesting aspect about this case, though, is in addition to AM General complaining about the use of the car or the Humvee in the game, they're also taking aim at Call of Duty's merchandising, because the merchandise that's sold in conjunction with the game includes little Humvees and some of these other registered trademarks that AM General is concerned about. And so not only are we talking about use of it in the expressive work itself, but also in kind of commercialized product. So that's an interesting additional angle that's going to be brought to bear here in this case. Should be really fascinating to see what happens.
Mike, if Activision had gone out and photographed or filmed real battle scenes and used that as their backdrop against which to have players do their thing, would we be having this conversation?
I think that's even probably a stronger case for the defendant if that were to happen, saying, look, we're using actual realistic footage. You can't stop us from doing that. It seems like the First Amendment argument gets that much stronger. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that necessarily makes the argument about the merchandising aspect any stronger, because at the end of the day, what the plaintiff's going to say is, look, okay, yeah, you may have a First Amendment right associated with creating an expressive work and using our works in that capacity, but when you start to sell freestanding copies of our trademark Humvee, you know, that's a little bit of a one-off. At least that would be the argument, I think.
Got it.
Mike, I'm not as familiar with trademark law as you. What's the baseline? So if this was a Ford truck in a civilian type situation, would they need to get a license for that? And maybe, like, is it typical with game license where, like, do airplanes need license for it? Like, do companies get licenses from, like, Boeing if they're showing, like, a commercial jetliner or something like that?
You know, Matt, it's a really good question. I don't know what the typical practices are with content creators if they're going out and licensing all of the trademarks here. But I think the analysis still holds, even if this was I don't know if the analysis holds. Let me say that, because using a Ford pickup truck in your game doesn't strike me that you need to use a particular Ford pickup truck or a Ford pickup truck in order to make your game realistic. I think the argument is particularly strong in this case because Humvees are such an integral part of any sort of military operation that they need to be incorporated in this particular context in order to give the game that realistic feel that it has.
So, Mike, I've got a couple questions from the Slack or from the chat as well on that similar issue, I guess. Would that be the same argument for the use of, like, Colt 45 or Black Hawk helicopter or these other sort of brand name and individual identifier for, like, specific weapons and other things that the military uses because they're sort of standard stock? That would be the defense argument.
Yeah, I think that's probably right, Emery. It seems like that would be a similar argument.
What do you say? We've got a couple questions in the chat about the idea that, well, is this not from a trademark perspective, but from a copyright perspective, because if this was a design that was done for the government, would it be a work for hire? Is there anything that is sort of, you know,
where this could be fair use,
triggering any ideas in your head there?
Yeah,
or not copyrighted.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that a work was created by the federal government, then of course there would be no copyright protection associated with that work, and the government couldn't claim copyright protection. And I'm sorry, what was the other part of your question, Emery?
Well, the question was basically I was trying to get out of not having a formal question formalized in my mind when I started talking, but I was essentially trying to get you to opine on the relationship between copyrighted works that maybe worked for hire for the government, and whether there's any sort of room for a copyright discussion in this case. But again, I haven't really thought this out all the way. So
So if let's say that that there was copyright protection associated with the Humvee itself. If there was a copyright, and I'm not sure if copyright comes into play in the case, I think this is primarily just a trademark case, but I think the argument would be similar that would be made here is that, look, even though we are using it, we've incorporated it into our game, it's sufficiently transformative. We've created this expressive work and we're incorporating it for limited purpose of just creating this realistic look and feel to the gaming environment. So I think mm-hmm. it would be a similar argument under copyright as well.
Does it help them if they've taken off the logos, or is it just the distinctive shape of the truck that they're able to get a trademark in?
That always confuses me about trademark.
Yeah. So there's really two aspects to that. Certainly the logo mm-hmm. can act as a source identifier itself, whatever AM General logos are incorporated. I don't know if it's logos themselves that are at issue here. I thought it was more in terms of the grill mm-hmm. and the actual look and feel, the shape of the Humvee itself.
Right. All right. So an interesting one to watch. We will try and continue to do so. But in the meantime, the Supreme Court has finished up hearing all the cases that it's going to hear this year. And it heard an interesting patent one that Matt's going to tell us about. Oil States Energy, Matt, what was at stake here?
So at stake here is the entire constitutionality of the American Invents Act. The American Invents Act took what had previously been ex parte hearings in regards to for a limited time. I think it's less than a year after a patent is granted, you could go back and appeal to the PTO about the patentability of that. But it was an ex parte hearing between the administrative judge and the other party. What the American Invents Act did was made it an adversarial process where there are two – so the EFF actually gets involved in a lot of these. And I think 30% of cases are brought by not parties, as in like they wouldn't reach Article III standing where there's a case for controversy. They're individuals who are just think that the patent's not valid. So what they do is they file an AIA proceeding. It goes through a trial. It's a limited discovery. There's a couple issues that cannot be opined upon by the administrative judge. I can't recall off the top of my head what they are. But and then it goes to a final ruling. And then as opposed to other administrative proceedings, it goes directly to the Federal Circuit. And the reason is that what the Congress was worried about, particularly back then, is that the time of getting to a patent process just takes way too long. And so they needed a process to, if a patent was granted and it looked like it wasn't, it wasn't a real patent, it had obviousness issues, it had any sort of issues, that they wanted to reach a resolution for that. The issue brought by the plaintiff is that this removes the Article III power from the judges of determining the cases. And so what's come to light in the trial is that some of the things that the judges are particularly worried about is that you can go through this AIA proceeding and then the administrator, the head of the USPTO, can restack the judges who are on the case and hear it again. So this has only happened three times, and it's not – and they ended up settling, so it's not clear if that would have changed the outcome or anything. But this is kind of getting back to the discussion about the copyright small claims court, is that when you put an administrator in charge of ALJs, you provide the – you know, the whole administrative state is set up so that the executive has the power. And so it removes that power from the judges. And that's the concern. So although it looked like this was going to be upheld I would say that, you know, 75% of academia thought that this was going to be upheld. The judges were much more skeptical, especially Justice Breyer and Justice Sotomayor. You know, they thought that Thomas and Alito might have said that this is unconstitutional because there's a case in 1890 which says it's a private right and therefore you can't take it away through an ALJ. But Sotomayor and Breyer pushed back a lot more on a due process analysis that that you could have your rights taken away sort of in this way where you could win once and then go back and have that reversed essentially by the administrator, that your private rights could be taken that way. So it'll be a really, really interesting case to see. There's been about 1,400 patents invalidated in the last 5 years. And if this was reversed, it would be a real question of, you know, can they enforce those patent rights that had previously been invalidated? And that would just be a mess, but it would be kind of cool to see.
Mm-hmm. So sounds good. We'll wait to hear from the Supreme Court on that. Mike, do you have any thoughts?
It's puzzled me about this case, Matt. You know, typically the Supreme Court takes a case when there's a circuit split, and it's going to kind of come in and break the tie and decide what the law should be. But as I understand it, I mean, we're not dealing with the circuit split here, right? I mean, this is the only case that's decided or had been decided regarding whether this was constitutional or not. You would have thought that they would have just not even taken the case. If they're going to affirm the constitutionality of this process, you would have thought that they would just not have accepted the case, right?
Because they've moved the entire procedure and basically all of the patent administration of the patent venue went from a federal judge to the AIA. There is some argument that they just wanted to get it there and affirm it quickly so that there wasn't uncertainty about that. I'm not sure how much I buy that. I'm not sure which four votes got it to there. I'm miffed on how it got up there as quickly as it did. That being said, because it's a patent case, though, too, it can't have a circuit split because all the patent decisions are determined by the federal circuit. So it's not that, in copyright, there's a circuit split, but in patent law. But there was only one or two district judges that ruled upon this, and then the federal circuit ruled. So, the federal circuit has been overruled time and time again by the Supreme Court. I'm not sure if this is another one. One of the really interesting things of this is that Chief Justice Roberts got really upset that the head of the ALJ for the USPTO is called the Chief Justice. So in a note to legislators, don't call the head judge the Chief Justice because that may lose you a vote on the Supreme Court. And the funnier thing was that the Chief Justice of the ALJ was actually in the room while Chief Justice Roberts was disparaging him. So
it's good to be the judge.
What are you going to do?
Ouchie. Emery, any thoughts?
No, I'm just front row seats for this analysis.
Yes, me too. All right. Let us move on to we mentioned we were going to bring Judge Alsup back in a different context, and we are. Guess what? Oracle versus Google is still in court, and we'll give you the latest. Speaking of things being argued before the Federal Circuit, that's what happened this week in the case that we covered extensively when it was at trial, the Oracle versus Google decision that involved the copyrightability of APIs and whether or not Google had a valid fair use argument in using some of the it's Java, right? That's at issue here. The Java API in its own products. So this is this came up for review before the Federal Circuit, and that seems strange because this is not a patent issue. It did not go to the Ninth Circuit. It went to the Federal Circuit. Mike, do you know why?
Yeah, because the case, even though it turned out to be a copyright case, there were patent claims initially.
Yeah. Oh.
And I think if there's patent claims involved in a case, it's going to go to the Federal Circuit regardless. I believe that's how that shakes out.
Yeah, that was my guess. So we had oral argument this week where Oracle is taking aim at that determination by the jury in the trial court that Google was justified in using parts of the Java API under the fair use doctrine. And from the commentators I've read and we've linked to in our discussion points that you can look at for yourself, it sounds like Oracle's got kind of heavy slog here to try and get that set aside. Do you agree, Mike?
I would have agreed with that going into it, but then when I listened to the oral arguments, and I didn't listen to the whole thing, but I listened to some of the questions that were posed to Google's lawyer, that gave me pause because it seemed like what a couple of the judges were concerned about is that this jury verdict on fair use is a black box. And I think what the judges were concerned about potentially, kind of reading tea leaves here, of course, but the jury decided the issue of fair use. That was really the only issue in the second trial. The jury came back and the jury questionnaire, I think it had one question. Do you find that Google's use is fair use? And they answered yes. One of the judges said, well, look, and I'm paraphrasing here, fair use, it's got four factors. And we have no way of determining, as we're sitting here as an appellate body, what factors were considered by the jury. How did they come out on the first factor, you know, the most important factor? What about market harm? You know, so I think a judge or a couple of the judges seemed a little bit concerned about the quote unquote black box nature of this verdict. So I don't know. It's hard to forecast this one. But I'm,
well, let's spin that forward for a moment. If the judges were to reverse because they didn't like the jury form, and the jury form didn't go through each of the fair use factors and say, do you find that the defendant did this? Do you find the defendant did this? Does that mean that this case will have invalidated a jury form that didn't go through those factors?
I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, it's going to be, it's got to be Oracle's, it's Oracle's burden to appeal and establish that something went wrong at the trial court. And I think it's a different question. There's a slight difference here between saying we can't tell as an appellate body as to what factors they relied on versus we can tell, and we can tell that they didn't apply the law correctly here, or there wasn't sufficient evidence. I don't know. I mean, it's I'm somewhat confounded after listening to the oral argument as to what the court's going to settle in on here.
Right. Did you listen live?
No, I listened to it after the fact.
Right. What were you going to ask, Matt?
Isn't the nature of the problem sort of confounding, though, that we've got a four-factor test that we don't really know which factor matters the most, and we don't really know how to add them up. And so even if you had all the four factors listed out and said that, you know, this one matters, how's the jury supposed to determine, like, this one matters X amount, this one matters Y amount? And, like, so even if the box is, like, unblackened, do we get any more insight by having a checkbox of, you know, it's transformative, but there's no market harm and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's still whether you're going to leave it up to the jury or not. That's really the question.
Great point.
Yeah, I think that's right, Matt. I guess I would say, well, depending on how they answer the question, you could get some insight into what they considered and whether there's sufficient evidence to support that. For example, if they said there is no market harm, if that was one of the inquiries in this special verdict form, if let's say they said there was no market harm, they answered affirmatively or in the negative, that there was no harm to Oracle. If Oracle could show, look, there's a tremendous amount of evidence here, overwhelming amount of evidence that there's market harm. I'm not saying there is, but you know, you could, depending on the nature of how they answered the question and how the evidence came in, you know, you could get some more insight into what happened and potentially what went wrong in the jury room.
But if they said there's a lot of market harm, but there's just a little transformation, and we think that adds up to fair use, I don't see how that outcome changes. So they have to get, like, the facts right, as in, like, if there's $1 billion of harm, you have to admit that there's $1 billion of harm. But it still doesn't help you add up, you know, the factors anymore.
Yeah. No, you're right. I agree with you. I mean, so there's always going to be this black box aspect to it when you pose it to the jury, when the jury's going to decide it.
Right. And that's not just true in the fair use context. That's why it's weird to me that this was such an issue for the panel, or it came across that way in oral argument that it was such an issue, because appellate judges see this kind of thing all the time. Juries are instructed on what the law is. And, you know, let's think about fraud. They're asked to say whether a party committed fraud, but they're given instructions on what all the elements of fraud are. And then they go in and they match up the facts to see if they think that happened. And you don't know what led them to say there was fraud, but they say there was fraud, and then the person's got to pay a lot of money. I don't really see, the juries are asked to do this all the time.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Absolutely. If by chance this is remanded back to Judge Alsup, this will be the third. This would be the third trial potentially. I mean, it's assuming that it's remanded for a third trial. So, this is a case that just never ends.
Right. All right. Well, that's the latest in Oracle versus Google. We have one other interesting little tidbit to discuss with you all concerning the Consumer Review Fairness Act. And, that came up in a terms of service context. I just love it when people read the terms of service that they are agreeing or deciding not to agree to. And that's what happened here. User Matt Weeks on Twitter was a would-be ADT customer. ADT is a home security company, and actually was reading through the terms and conditions before he clicked the big green button that said accept new conditions and continue. And he spotted that there was a little clause that said if you agreed, you were agreeing not to disparage ADT's product products or services or any of ADT's affiliates or their products or services? And Matt said, heck no. In fact, he said the answer is no, and I'm quitting your service and I'm going to a competitor. He tweeted that. You don't want bad reviews, try better prices and service, not this kind of shady legal garbage. Well, it turns out Matt probably didn't know, and it turns out I'm guessing ADT did know, or at least some of its lawyers should have known, that last year Congress enacted a piece of legislation that was designed to do away with clauses just like this, called the Consumer Review Fairness Act. And it took into account that feedback from customers is incredibly important. It helps people's buying decisions, and there are policy reasons to protect it. And it wanted to do away with what Professor Goldman calls anti-review clauses. Professor Goldman has an excellent explanation, Understanding the Consumer Review Fairness Act of 2016, that you can look up and read for yourself if you want to have a deeper understanding of this act and what it prevents. And this, the kind of thing it prevents, one would think that ADT's lawyers, as I said, knew or should have known this. But here is this clause still in the terms of service. ADT did respond and said, thank you for sharing your concerns. We believe we have taken the necessary steps to correct this issue. We hope that you continue to be part of the ADT family, blah, blah, blah. So somebody went to the legal department and said, hey, why is this in there? It looks bad for us.
They succeeded in taking their foot out of one foot out of their mouth and taking the other one and putting it right back in there.
Absolutely. Tell us what the other foot then walked right into.
So in their apology, they say the non-disparagement clause you're referencing only applies to linking to our website, and it's not a condition of service or using myadt.com. So to avoid any confusion, and since this is not considered a condition of service, we will be removing the clause from our website's terms and conditions, which is also dumb and ridiculous because it gets into a free speech thing where they're saying that, you're saying that we can't disparage you as long as you're linking back to us, which is
right.
Emery, are they making that argument to try to get out from the federal legislation? Is that what the argument is?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine. When I see this, when I saw this, I just assumed that this was either a term that they had kept in their terms and conditions from like 2 years ago, and they hadn't updated it from the Protection Act. But or it's just like bad lawyering, because I mean, I think that any reading of the language of the terms and condition that they had before made it pretty clear that it was a clear non-disparagement clause, and so their excuse. I don't know. I don't have any good reason for why they would say that.
Did you guys see that Pope Hat, which is a long, long time legal blog, tweeted out about this? Wait a minute, ADT. It's your position that we may not link to your website if we disparage it or you. So, like, I'm violating your rules if I say ADT.com hires general counsel from a bus station restroom. And then,
if you're interested in the law and you're not following Pope Hat, you're doing something wrong. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yes, exactly.
Is there any bite to the Federal Protection Act? As in, like, if companies put this on their terms and condition, is there any liability for them?
I don't think there's any bite.
Yeah, I think this is monitored by the FTC and individual state attorneys general. I don't think it provides for a private cause of action.
No, okay. But it would be really, really funny if a company were to say, hey, we've got a non-disparagement clause. We're going to enforce it. You disparaged us. That would be fun to see them try and do.
Yeah, I mean, but
they can't.
It happened, and they got shut down.
to the extent, though, that people are actually reading those, you know, the issue is that people take them as, you know, not everyone listens to our podcast. You know, the few people who don't. They should. But the few people who don't would know that, you know, that they can't actually, you know, they don't know about this law. And so they don't know that they can't say that. So if the effect of the statement is that it's going to silence speech, then that seems like an issue.
Certainly seems like unfair and deceptive business practices that you would hope the FTC would come down on.
You would. You would indeed. All right. Well, we are coming into the final concluding material for our final concluding show of the week. Let's start with our animal selfie of the week. Sorry, of the year. Final concluding show of the year.
Every time I see the animal selfie of the week, listeners, I understand if you don't watch the show. I only listened to this podcast for the like 2.5 years or 3 years before I started working here. But you really should at least once pull up the video and just watch it just for the animal selfie music video thing that we have. It's incredible. It was made by one of our listeners, I think. So
No, it was made by the studio. Victor, did you make the animal selfie bumper?
Yes.
Yes. Oh. Thank you, Victor.
Well, apologies and thank you, Victor.
He's one of our listeners. It's fine.
That's right. Yeah, he has to listen whether he wants to.
Yeah, I listen every week.
Exactly. So our animal selfie this week, in the spirit of the holidays, is a ne'er-do-well squirrel that was messing with the holiday lights display of the Seagirt Police Department somewhere lovely in New Jersey. If you pull up their Facebook page, it looks like they are right on the shore somewhere. The Seagirt Police Department had a problem. Its holiday lights went up, but then stopped working, and they could not figure out why. I cannot tell if they used a trap camera, some sort of motion-activated self-snapping camera. It looks like they might have to catch the culprit in action, and it was a squirrel that scampered across to the fence where the lights were strung and appears to have nibbled through the light wiring. So caught in the act. Not quite sure if this qualifies as a classic animal selfie. The squirrel did not take the picture itself here, did not steal anybody's camera and rampage around through the light display. But I have the feeling that they may have used some sort of motion activated camera to get these nice shots of the squirrel. Because I assume that if a person was standing there with a camera, the squirrel would have run away and decided to gnaw on something else rather than give them, the police, no doubt, palpable evidence that the squirrel was committing what's got to be a misdemeanor of some kind in Seagirt, New Jersey. So there is our animal selfie of the week. And lo and behold, our tips of the week here also relate to animal selfies. And our tip of the week is, and we've talked over the years as we've been doing these animal selfies, which we started doing in honor of Naruto and the macaque and his case that wended its way through the courts for quite some time, that there are various kinds of animal selfies, and there are good kinds and bad kinds. And the kinds where you are trapping or capturing animals merely to exploit them and take pictures with them or encourage tourists to do so, of course, would be the bad kind. And Instagram has decided, based on a study done by National Geographic, that it is going to raise people's awareness about that issue, about harming or harassing animals, being cruel to and exploiting them, by certain search terms, and it hasn't said which ones are going to trigger a warning and a message from Instagram if you use them. And that warning and message is what it says. Animal abuse and the sale of endangered animals or their parts is not allowed on Instagram. You are searching for a hashtag that may be associated with posts that encourage harmful behavior to animals or the environment. So Instagram is concerned about this issue, and once it's users to be concerned too. So if you are searching for things like hashtag koala selfie or hashtag sloth selfie on Instagram, those two have been tested to definitely trigger this warning. So be careful out there, folks. There are good animal selfies and bad animal selfies. Just always be aware which kind you are promoting and engaging in before you go ahead and snap that photo or endorse that practice. So our resource of the week, we have a couple, a very dark one at the end of the year here. I hate to leave you with such a dark note, but I meant to mention this a couple of shows ago and just never got around to it. And it is this cool, if dark, video that is called, let's see, it is by a UC Berkeley professor named Stuart Russell, and also by autonomousweapons.org. And it has a very dark title, which I am looking for, involving slaughter.
Slaughterbots, right?
Slaughterbots, that's it. So it's like 7 minutes long, and it is a chilling tale of automated robot weapons coming to, you know, police and keep the world safe and secure, and gunning down parents, students in college, among other things. So it's definitely meant to raise awareness about the kinds of powers and discretion that we are giving to artificially intelligent entities, including those that can fire at us. What were you going to say, Emery?
Oh, I was just saying it is legitimately chilling. Like, we throw that word around sometimes, but like it has been on my mind since I watched it a few weeks ago. It's has shown up in a couple of dreams. And in fact, a friend of the show, a listener and friend of the show, Rebecca Krutoff, who's one of the foremost experts in autonomous weapons systems. You should follow her on Twitter, but she's got a great Twitter thread reaction to this video, talking about whether or not these are fully autonomous, or, you know, is there meaningful human control over these? Would they be banned by a quote unquote autonomous weapons systems ban? Because these are basically, you know, you set them the target and then they go and do it. Either way, it's super creepy, and I definitely recommend checking it out.
Yes, definitely. It also, apparently, I haven't made my way to this episode of Black Mirror yet, but it reminded several people of the bees episode of Black Mirror, of the swarm episode.
Isn't there a Michael Crichton book about that too?
Bought bees. I don't know. I haven't read it.
The swarm, maybe? I don't know. Swarm.
Yes. So on a lighter note, why don't you tell us, Emery? I wanted to put out there as a resource the International Association of Privacy Professionals. Can you tell us more about that and the sort of certification that you're interested in getting from them?
Sure. So the IAPP is the world's largest information privacy community, and they offer several certification programs to get you up to speed in privacy regulations and the law. One of them that they offer is one covering CIPE, or the European privacy landscape, including the GDPR, which I'm sure for anyone in the listeners that are in privacy or are interested in getting into privacy, know that that is a huge issue. So it's on my Christmas list. If anyone wants to gift me certs.
Yes, we hope you get sippy for Christmas.
Either that or the new Mario. I'm okay with either, really.
Right. It's interesting that there are organizations out there, or this one in particular, that will, you know, whether regardless of the field you're in, will certify that you are very knowledgeable about important privacy issues, because I think
I also misspoke a little
learn
bit.
They week in and week out here, they are among the most important issues facing our society right now.
I would certainly agree. I do want to point out that I misspoke. It's not purely for attorneys. They also have certifications for IT with a privacy bent. They also have certifications for management. So definitely go and check it out if you're interested in privacy. I think it's, again, it's something that everyone should at least brush up on. It's impacting basically everything on every part of our lives.
All right. I need another MCLE passphrase. Any suggestions, anyone?
You're so good at coming up with these, though, Denise.
Emery, I like what you said before. You earlier on in the show, you said buildings of lawyers when you were discussing something.
That'll do it. Buildings of lawyers is our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Emery. And thank you all for joining us this week on our final 2017 episode of This Week in Law. We are still taking suggestions for our best of the year episode, which will air on December 29th. You go to twit.tv/best of. Please do let us know what were some of your favorite moments from our show this year. We'd love to hear from you about that as we put the show together. We are going to be on a winter break hiatus, I think, until January 19th. I put my calendar away, but I think that's what we were saying before the show. It's going to be our next episode of Twill. So we will miss you all. We hope you have a delightful and restful and peaceful and wonderful holiday. In the meantime, definitely look for that best of episode from us at the end of the year. And you can always go to our archive, which is at twit.tv/twill. Look back on this year, prior years, try and understand the whole net neutrality debate as it has unfolded since 2010, because we've been following it for at least that long, and other things, all at twit.tv/twill. Suggestions on how you can watch the show, where you can find all of the discussion points for all of the shows. If you're interested in digging deeper into our source material, it's all there for you. Thank you for checking it out there and supporting the show. Thank you for your feedback to us. You can get back to us with suggestions for the show or thoughts about anything that we've discussed, suggestions for people that you'd like to see us have on the show or invite on the show. Reach out to any of us at Twitter. Or the show at Twitter is This Week in Law. That is probably the less effective way of getting in touch with us, but it's a great way to know when new shows have come out, et cetera. This Week in Law has its own Twitter page, but it's not very communicative on Twitter. You're much more likely to reach me if you go to D. Howell. Mike is J. Michael Keys on Twitter. Emery is Emery Roan on Twitter. And Matt is Lawpint. Both Emery and Matt are involved in their own podcasts. Emery, you referred to yours once in the show. Tell us again what it is called and who you are doing it with.
Sure. It's Tech Policy Grind. You can find it wherever you find your podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, et cetera. If you have any problems with those feeds, let me know. It's but it's a podcast that we're doing with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, where we bring other policy or Foundry fellows and friends of the Foundry on to both talk about current events and interesting things in the legal tech world, but also to highlight the journey that these early career professionals have had to get where they are, to sort of shine a light on the fact that you, listener, yes, you can be in this field too. And we have a great time. We've got an episode dropping on Monday on net neutrality. It's the first one we've had where we formatted it like a debate. So I'm interested in hearing responses from that. And again, I would love for you guys to take a listen, rate, review us, tell your friends, and tell me that you did it too, because that makes me feel good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to listening to that one. And Matt does a podcast called A Pint of Law. Remind our listeners who are not already loyally subscribing what you do there, Matt.
So we have taken a rather large hiatus with that. But it's mm-hmm. the format's rather simple, that we interview individuals who have written law review articles. I've been running a cancer diagnostic company for the last several months, though, and my investors are quite happy that I'm only on one podcast a week.
Are you doing that? We should have you on as a guest, Matt.
Yes.
What's that?
And we will.
We need to have you on as a guest. I just want to hear you talk about your story, because I cannot imagine doing what you're doing all at the same time. Frankly,
podcasts on and audiobooks on times two or three are very helpful.
I'm right there with you.
And so that has been long delayed, and hopefully we'll make enough money so that I can pay someone else to do it for a little bit. But I've enjoyed being on This Week in Law so much that it's made the choice easy. But I still have the Twitter handle, which. Someday we'll come back, because it, as Mike said, it's a great name and it's a good tagline, and so it needs to be revived at some point. But if anyone has a time turner, I'm willing to. There's stock options available if you can get me one. So that's my life. And
I think probably the closest I can get is to take you on the Universal Studios tour when you come to California to visit. We'll look for one there.
I am in. The yes. 2nd through the 8th, I'm going to be in San Diego and Laguna. So we'll have to make
good
it work.
To know. Yeah.
Oh, very good. Yeah, definitely get in touch with me toward the end of that, and let's see if we can make it work to get together. And then another thing you can do while we're taking a bit of a holiday and winter break here is read and follow the TMCA, which is the blog at Dorsey & Whitney that Mike is instrumental in putting together and contributing to. Wonderful resource on the web.
Thank you. Yeah. And it was a great year with all of you here, and had a lot of fun, and looking forward to 2018 and beyond.
Yes, us as well. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us. Thank you so much, Mike, Emery, and Matt. Really can't thank you guys enough for a wonderful 2017. And Victor in the studio, too. Yay! Round of applause for Victor. Thank
Bravo.
You, Victor.
Thanks, studio.
Thanks, guys.
Round of applause for Denise for orchestrating all this and keeping the show running for 400-plus episodes, everyone. Can you believe it?
Amazing.
Woo-hoo. 409. We're cleaning up here on episode 409. Ha, ha, ha. No trademark infringement intended. All right. With that, we will sign off and wish you a great rest of the year. We'll see you in January. Until then, take care.